Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sari, and today we are exploring whether having elections can be considered a prerequisite for democratic governance. Joining us from here in Washington, D.C. are two distinguished guests. Dr. Piwokule Munyandu, a lecturer at Howard University here in Washington, D.C., and Norman Mbabazi, a Ugandan lawyer who is visiting the United States. Well, gentlemen, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Pleasure is all ours.
It's good to be here.
Good to be here.
It's always a pleasure talking to you guys, and let me wish you, by the way, a hugely happy and prosperous 2021.
Thank you, Shaka. The
Thank
same
you.
To you.
You're most welcome, gentlemen. Now, gentlemen, we're going to be talking about whether holding elections is a prerequisite for democratic or good governance. What, for example, would you say makes an election acceptable to all the parties involved? Makes an election, for example, which can be characterized as free, fair, transparent, verifiable, and a credible election. Professor.
I'm going to perhaps start by using an example I'm personally familiar with, South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I will perhaps answer your question by defining a credible election and a fair election by what actually exists and what doesn't exist at a certain time. There was a time in South Africa until 1994 that not everyone could vote. And so there was democracy, but it was esoteric. It was only for white citizens of South Africa. So that was, so any election then, therefore, that took place before 1994 could not be said to have been credible, fair, and so on and so forth. So we could say then, deduce from that, that a fair and credible election involves the participation of all citizens in electing their representative. So full participation guaranteed, and the election must be, in South Africa, people emphasized this a lot in 1994, free of intimidation, and the choice and the election itself, as far as each citizen, must be a secret ballot. No one must know what you voted, in other words. So these three ingredients, primary ingredients, I would say, using the case of South Africa in 1994, I think formed a benchmark for the country from which other characteristics, of course, may cohere, I would say. But that's a good start.
So, Doctor, could we then say that perhaps what you are actually trying to put across is that in South Africa, during the apartheid era, we did have what appeared to be democratic elections, but that perhaps these elections, in fact, were a sort of selective democracy, the sort of elections that were clearly not inclusive.
Indeed, that is why the word I used was esoteric democracy, only for a few. So the access, there was a gatekeeping according to race. And so if you were 80% of the population of South Africa, you never knew democracy within the borders of the country until 1994. So if you talk to a South African today who's, let's just say, at the age of 55 and above, if they vote, they voted, they remember that election for the rest of their lives because it was the first time that they and all of us as a result tasted democracy. So an election must have, it must guarantee full participation, and it must guarantee secrecy of the ballot. so that there's no retribution afterwards in areas that are considered a stronghold of this and that a party. I think that's a good benchmark we can take away from the small example of South Africa.
Interesting. What about you, Norman Mbabazi? Is that something that you would agree with?
Speaking from my experience from Uganda, where we've had a series of coups instead of elections, and the times we attempted to have elections in the 80s, they were rigged, and then the current president, General President Museveni, at the time felt that the nature of elections that had been organized by the then government were not those that brought out the characteristics of a democratic society. And when he went to the bush, his idea was he was fighting to for the people to recover their freedom and to be able to exercise their will as democracy requires. However, after that, in 1986, when he took over power, the first times when, until 1996, when we held the first election under his regime, and an election which is characterized by the incumbent appointing the referee of the election, where he's playing as a player, creates such a situation that if you don't make reference to me as the leader or as the winner, you will not. Why did I appoint you to be a referee in this game? So, and he has profoundly said that we shall not prepare elections for you to win us. In other words, the elections are a face. So the president will always win, but the people will lose. In other words, the democracy in the Ugandan elections, in my opinion, have never seemed to reflect the intentions or the will of the electorate. So I could simply put it that the many times we've had elections in Uganda, the winner or the selected winner for that matter has always been the one who appoints the referee. So for me, the starting point of a democratic election or an election which has a semblance of democracy, the Electoral Commission must be independent in such a way that it has the will to properly declare the winner if at all the incumbent has lost. And, you know, and other characteristics definitely follow an impartial judicial system that if the election, there is a petition, they will substantially look at all the matters to be able to bring out the real issues that occurred in such an election.
What about a free or independent media that can be accessible by the all parties competing, for example, in an election?
Right from 2001, 2011, and 2016, those have been issues pointed out in the various election petitions that should be considered and reformed such that all the participants are able to get access to media coverage, because how else shall we know the competence of an election if the media is closed out? You've been seeing in the elections, current campaigns that have been going on, that almost 39 journalists, their credentials were taken away. And the accrediting body also has an appointment by the same the incumbent, who definitely will not accredit various independent journalists who are moving alongside the various campaigning candidates to be able to capture what's happening on ground. So indeed, if we don't have a good media law which allows all the participants to access to have good publicity, if you don't have a system which is free for media reporting, where there is no censorship, you know, in certain areas where the certain candidates would even pay to be hosted on a TV or a radio program, and a few hours or even minutes to the program starting, and you're told you cannot be allowed to be on this program. And then how else will you communicate to the people? Indeed.
Very interesting. Now, Norman, you basically pretty much characterized the type of elections that happen or obtain in Uganda. How do you respond to President Yoweri Tibuhaburwa, who is on record saying that, yes, he actually went to the bush to fight for the restoration of democracy in Uganda, and that he, in fact, brought you back your democracy? How do you react to that?
He, for me, in my opinion, I think he misrepresents democracy and the semblance of stability in a country. Much as many times he refers to stability in sense to mean democracy. His idea is you are able to speak, you are able to speak as you wish. I've given you freedom of speech, restricted freedom of speech, by the way. And you are able to engage in electoral processes. But these electoral processes are tagged with a lot of circumstances. For example, if you go, there's the electoral process, which is marred with intimidation, availability of security forces at electoral places, failure to allow all the contestants to navigate the country as they wish, gagging consultations. It is a semblance of democracy in his own words, but in my opinion, that democracy that he preaches does not necessarily reflect the contents of democracy, especially in an electoral process.
Interesting. Now, Dr. Munyandu, how do you define or how do you characterize democracy? We know, for example, that a one great American president by the name Abraham Lincoln. I remember that name precisely because, in fact, I first came across it when I was in Kigezi High School primary in Kabale, in primary 6, studying civics.
Mm.
And when they said democracy, the next thing you'd hear is Abraham Lincoln. That Abraham Lincoln once said that in his view, democracy is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. What is your definition of democracy as you have seen it being practiced on the ground in Africa?
It's an onerous task, Shaga. I don't think a humble man like myself could give an adequate enough definition of democracy. So I'll even defer to that one and just add to it. Democracy, especially in Southern Africa, I would say, is a dynamic system characterized by change. And also it's an asymmetrical system. Now, it's not equal in many other countries, though it may look so, right? So it's dynamic, characterized by constant change, asymmetrical. It's applied differently or it occurs differently in various countries. And then, of course, whereby the people themselves choose their representatives. And I'll just maintain that humble definition, because once we give it, we start from a humble standpoint when we're defining democracy, we're able to appreciate something very important with democracy in Africa. How it has undergone various stages depending on the country. Some countries have what we might call a mature democracy. What do I mean by that? That is when the party that brought independence has been successfully challenged. Sometimes it has been unseated, as we saw in Zambia. Sometimes it has been challenged to the point of almost losing, and some might say lost, as in the case of ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe in 2008. And then you have nascent democracies. Nascent democracies would be South Africa, would be with ANC, SWAPO in Namibia, Frelimo in Mozambique, Chama Cha Mapinduzi in Tanzania, where the parties of independence, the ones that say, and I think this claim sometimes we are being unfair to the parties, so I will not evaluate whether it's good or it's right or wrong for them to say this, but where they say, we brought you, like in the case of Uganda, as Paul has outlined, where they say, we brought you independence. These are nascent democracies. Whether they've been a democracy for 30 years or 20, they're nascent because the party that rules has not been successfully put through a referendum, a successful referendum, or defeated.
How do you respond to some who would in fact look at that type of democracy as a government of some people, by some people, and for some people?
Well, I think that there are, this is why it's important, full participation guaranteed is an important benchmark of democracy, because once some people find it easier to vote and some do not, once there are barriers to election, in the case of Africa, a barrier could simply be how far is the voting booth in this village. So if you have to walk over 5 kilometers in order to vote in a place where, in a village where not a lot of people have cars, that means the person who brings a bus to transport all of you in this valley, and if that person is wearing a shirt of a certain party, and even if it doesn't say the name, by simply wearing green in Tanzania, you are left with no doubt as to the patronage to whom you owe your vote. And so such practices, these are nuanced practices. So we must have a very clear eye and be careful when we're looking at them. But such practices actually fight against democracy.
And what about you, Norman? What is your definition of democracy as you know it, and as you also have lived through that type of experience?
Well, in a democratic state that I envisage to see many years to come, probably for Uganda, that is to say, where we expect full participation of the people who have reached the age of election, where we all access media, where there is no disenfranchisement of voters, and there is no intimidation. Now, in that state of expectation that my heart feels for, moving away or trying to step aside from the normal norm of democracy being related only to numbers. They say democracy is for numbers. The bigger the number, that's the right democratic decision that has been taken. Now, if I were only to tackle the issue of numbers as a principle of democracy, that creates a problem for Uganda, where the numbers are always computed by certain groups of people and only given to the chairman of the Electoral Commission to announce. So ideally, it would be democratic in their mind, but because it's a numbers game. But the process and the procedure to arrive at a democratic election would have been marred by a lot of activities which defeat the essence of democracy. Especially now, the after effects of such an election in the so-called democratic state is that it totally comes back to what you have just said, a government for certain people, by certain people, because those people who participated in the making of that that government come through will definitely be the ones to benefit shortly after its existence.
You know, Norman, I have looked at the trajectory of democracy on the African continent during the last almost 30 years as a professional journalist. And I have found, and this information is also corroborated by a lot of African experts, African observers, policymakers in the Western world who interact and deal with Africa, that when you look at the democratic trajectory as far as Africa is concerned, that it looks good. And the reason they say so is because they say, as you said much earlier, that there was a period in the history of Africa where you hardly held elections. And of course, as we have heard, even in South Africa during apartheid, where they could hold an election, that election was clearly not an inclusive type of democracy. So these people say, when they look at the trajectory of democracy on the African continent, they say it is better because, in their view, most African countries hold periodic elections. How do you respond to that?
The only elections that are held are, in my opinion, are simply to legitimize the regime, but they are not the process. Because you see, elections are two things. It is the process and the result. So if you tamper with the process, then you have ideally managed the result ultimately. Now, what happens in many of these African countries is the process is completely distorted, in the sense that for example, at the time when Uganda first felt the nature of opposition politics, that's during the time of Dr. Kizza Besigye, he truly stood out as because he was formerly with the ruling party, defected, formed his own party, and he had all the weight with him, and he created his time. We felt at that was the time when Uganda witnessed the strength of the opposition. Dr. Kizza Besigye, with all his might at the time, was arrested not less than 200 times or more. Every other minute he was arrested. All at any one point he attempted to visit a certain constituency, there was intimidation by the military. I want to say that the electoral process in many African countries has been militarized, in the sense that you will not go anywhere. During even the, for example, after elections, we have a 5-year period. And during that time, the gentleman, Dr. Kizza Besigye, in many times could not leave his home. He was not allowed to move. And for me, that's what I call the process.
Norman, wait a minute. You mean Colonel Dr. Kizza Besigye was often arrested for no apparent reason at all? Or is it possible that perhaps he had violated some electoral codes?
The many times he was arrested, it was for no apparent reason, because even when he went to court, he was charged with flimsy charges, and there was never any conviction. Legally, for me, that would be a malicious prosecution, because one, you don't have the facts, the law is not with you, but because of ulterior political motives, he could not go to his, there's a point he couldn't go to his bank. because when he moved out, he was the people's president. The government feared his movement would converge people and could, and that was a time when we were having a couple of uprisings in different Arabian countries, the African countries. And the idea was that if the Ugandans are alert and alive to the events in the other African countries, Uganda would also catch the same flu. So they deliberately kept him inside his house to avoid such a situation where he will converge people probably as he moves around and cause peaceful demonstration. He always had peaceful demonstrations. He was, the peaceful demonstrations only turned violent when the police tried to block them and stop them from moving or showing their reasons why they are coming out. So I don't think that the gagging or the restraining of Dr. Kizza Besigye was always based on merit, but rather flouting the process of having a democratic election.
You described him as having been perceived by people as, quote, unquote, people's president.
Yes.
Why was he called the people's president, and by whom, and for, and why? I mean, and for what?
Because the people did not believe in the outcomes of the election. They always believed that he won the elections. And to the people, that is their person. The will of the people, in their numbers, they believe they chose Dr. Kizza Besigye as their president. But Mr. Museveni was selected for that position, but rather not elected as the people had done so. That's why he is called the people's president.
That sounds like you describing a cult and perhaps Dr. Colonel Kizza Besigye as the cult leader. The only other person I remember in history who was so popular, in fact globally, was Muhammad Ali, formerly Cassius Clay.
Yes.
At one time, obviously, the most prominent global fighter in terms of boxing, the heavyweight champion. People could not believe, even when he was beaten very badly in Madison Square Garden in New York by Joe Frazier, they still thought he had won, and they called him the people's champion, Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali.
Even though in many ways one could argue that he probably deserved it, given the kind of prominence he really did, and some of the important causes that he embraced that made him, obviously, the individual that was globally loved, adored, worshipped, to some degree, as a matter of fact.
I think, if I may, I think this discussion when someone has not won or is perceived to have, but is perceived to have won the election, whether rightly or wrongly, I think it brings a very important aspect of African democracy with which we must contend. This idea that one personality, whether they are opposition or not, tends to encapsulate or capture the support of a region or sometimes an ethnicity. So in our analysis of African democracy, we must not leave, like exceptions exist there and there, but we must also contend with this idea. I think fool ourselves sometimes when we're looking at Africans and their choices sometimes. In some countries, one person or a dynasty or an opposition party, sometimes they tend to be viewed as coming from one region or ethnicity. And I think in its quest to be fair and to improve, and this occurs differently in various countries, but Africans have failed to contend with this dynamic of their lives. That in some places, even if you put, just me, a short man from South Africa, But if I'm, you know, a certain ethnicity or from a certain region, I will capture the vote there. So our improvement of African democracy must seek to improve how this is moderated and how this affects people's lives.
Time is not our best ally, so we shall go for a break. And when we come back, we shall continue with the discussion. So please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, and today we are exploring whether having elections can be considered a prerequisite for democratic governance. My distinguished guests are Puokule Munyandu, lecturer of African Studies at Howard University here in Washington, D.C., and Norman Mbabazi, a lawyer with Nyanzi, Chiboneka, and Mbabazi Advocates in Uganda, who is currently visiting the United States. What about, going a little bit back to the issue that I raised earlier of the democratic trajectory? What do you think about this business of observers and experts talking about when it comes to democracy, at least in the view of those, some experts and what have you, they see democracy being on the upswing. They talk about, again, how we hold periodic elections, even when, in fact, you have a situation where in many countries across the continent, yes, they hold periodic elections, but at the end of the day, the results, in fact, reflect not the will of the voters, not the will of the people, but the will of the individual who announces the results or the individuals who actually count the votes. Should we really be satisfied with the fact that Africa is conducting periodic elections, or should we be looking at conducting elections that have merit, elections that really are quality elections, like South Africa, for example?
I think this is a very good question, Dr. Shaga, because it puts the ball of democracy and its improvement back to the Africans' courts, because then this way Africans themselves are able in each country to look themselves in the mirror and say, well, what have we done wrong? And what organic endogenous emanating from within the country, what endogenous mechanisms can we or should we improve? This idea of election observers, it has helped in some countries, especially in South Africa, where we really needed a fair assessment from outside. However, we can trace this idea of kind of conditions back to the 1990s, the structural adjustments and so on and so forth, where if you needed aid, you needed to do this and that, A, B, C, check these boxes, and you'd get aid. What that did, Dr. Shaga, it crept into the political space where the African leaders in many countries learned the rituals of a democracy. In other words, they learned to check the boxes so that when the observers from outside come, an exogenous process of assessment, when they come to, they will find everything correct and take the next flight away, but democracy in effect has not actually taken place. So the challenge then, which I think your question alludes to, is that the Africans themselves must now find, and looking forward, that's why I'm optimistic. They must find endogenous ways to assess their own democracies and improve them themselves.
Rulers must stop taking their own people through the motions.
No.
They should deliver democracy. Because democracy probably is really one of the prerequisites for bringing about social, economic, political, cultural justice for all.
The moment we have a situation where the political leaders choose the referee, I always refer to this word referee because of my love for football. Mm-hmm. The moment the referee...
Not only, by the way, do those individuals choose the referee only. Okay. They also go on and choose the linesmen. In fact, to a certain extent, they even choose the spectators. And the only thing they probably don't do, really, is to stop somebody to access oxygen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The moment we have that situation continuing in very many African countries, it is going to become a very tense moment for the development that we urge for. Because many times these selected leaders who have the referee by themselves, who have the linesmen, the lack, and they go on further and even deactivate civil society works. They turn out, they start taking on very vigorous and violent actions against the media and journalists. So if that doesn't stop, it is going to continue in such a way that all the time the leaders and will never deliver that democracy, because many times our president has once said, Mr. Museveni, that for him, he's working for his grandchildren and his children, which means the will of the people that put him in that office. And he further said he's not a servant of anybody. So in such a state where someone is not a servant of anybody, who is also working for his children and his grandchildren, what do you expect from such a leader? What is he going to deliver? Will he really deliver democracy, or will he simply deliver what is favorable for his children, his grandchildren, unless for the people that purportedly put him into power? Remember, people vote. Apparently, they go to the voting station. Some will be intimidated. Others will not turn up. The referee is on his side. So, and then he tops that up by saying he's a revolutionary leader and Africa still needs him. He has a lot of work to do. So, I want to remind you, Dr. Shaka, that this is a gentleman who said Africa's problem is leaders who overstay in power.
Well, he has since amended that he actually meant leaders who stay longer in power without being elected by their people.
Ah, amazing amendment.
Yeah. But staying with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, you said that he has actually said he is driven by working for his children and his grandchildren. Did he in fact say that, or was he in fact misquoted in fairness to him?
If you come out on an interview on TV and you say something like that, and you mention how you're working for that group of people, a select group of people, in all fairness, whether misquoted or not, it is, for me, in my opinion, it's unfair for a president to categorically enslave himself and narrow the margin of his expected output specifically to a certain group of people. My opinion would still not be different that he actually meant what he said, all fairness.
I see. Well, there doesn't seem to be a shortage of people, call them leaders or rulers, who apparently seem to have a sense of ownership, a sense of entitlement, as a matter of fact, because they say they and their colleagues woke up very early in the morning, went to the bush with the AK-47s, seized the power, and they say that the fact they were doing that precisely because they were liberating you. And because they say they were liberating you, not necessarily liberating themselves, they are entitled to calling shots in their countries.
I make reference to General Muntu. One time one of the conversations we had with him, General Mugisha Muntu was formerly the commander of the Uganda People's Defense Forces. And in the UPDF Act, he exists among the nationed, he's part of the council. You know, they have gone forward to also indicate who of these soldiers, the 23 that liberated
the 27, the number
the
27, the 27, yes.
The 27 that liberated the country, and they appear in a legislation to effect that they are the ones. They keep reminding us, and we are reminded, of course. So General Mugisha Muntu said that as they were getting done or towards the end of the war, some of the issues that he raised is, are we really still up to the task of liberating the people, or are we now to a new task of enriching ourselves? That during that time, he had observed some of his comrades had started earmarking certain properties that they would take over shortly after they had won the war. So it answers the question of entitlement. That see, the moment they felt the war was coming to the end, they started thinking of how they should reward themselves for the war of liberation. Now, the question is, were they liberating us, or they went into this art or the topic of liberation purposely for financial gain and to help themselves? Probably of all they had been deprived of, that was the time for them to enrich themselves.
Very interesting. Professor, let's look for some practical solutions here. Africa sincerely needs democracy, and democracy needs Africa. You know, on March 6, 1957, there was a gentleman called Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. He regained his country's political independence from the British. That country was called the Gold Coast. He renamed it the Republic of Ghana. And in his address to the people of Ghana, he challenged them. He said, the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it was linked with the total liberation of the rest of Africa. He did not only talk the talk, he actually walked that talk by providing the necessary tools so that the African people could in fact walk the walk, which they did in 1994 by South Africa becoming independent and ending apartheid under the leadership of the Madiba, the first indigenous South African president, Nelson Mandela. You know, I often wonder, South Africa is regarded by many as the beacon of hope for African democracy. Could it be that perhaps South Africa in fact has a responsibility to help democratize the rest of Africa?
I would be very skeptical of any efforts to enjoin South Africa in a continental project, because there are many factors that I play here that would determine the outcome of such an intervention. Some of these factors are, for example, are the countries whom South Africa would like to help with democracy? Are they Francophone or Anglophone, right? Because this will determine certain interests that might actually, or certain spheres of existence that might not be, that might be disrupted by South Africa trying this project. And another question I would ask, is South Africa up to the task? And I'm sorry, Shaka, to disappoint, but I'll say no, because South Africa has its own problems at home. Number one, in South Africa, an opposition has not won over 22%. So that means, that's why I call South Africa a nascent democracy. That means any opposition that has ever existed has a vote ceiling of 22%. And that is not bad if you're thinking of it that, well, it's democracy and the people voted. But that is bad if you're thinking about the fact that, well, if you know you have a, you've cornered the vote, are you going to deliver on many of your promises, especially developmental ones, when you know, look, the ANC will win again and again? So that means we must, for South Africa, we must rely on the ANC democratic processes themselves within the ANC, knowing that whoever the ANC puts most likely wins the election, at least for the foreseeable future. And on that score, I would say the ANC is found wanting, because right now it's undergoing a war of attrition between the factions that won from on which Ramaphosa ascended to power. So South Africa, I would say, is very busy with its own problems to be doing much proselytizing of democracy on the continent, however desirable that is, even to me.
But South Africa dominates, or at least at least attempts to dominate Africa when it comes to business. If it can in fact dominate Africa in terms of business, you go across the African continent and see a lot of these large shopping malls from Southern Africa through Eastern Africa to West Africa. I have been through South African shopping malls. If it can do that, really, why can't it also provide what is even more important, the foundation, which is a political infrastructure of democracy, as opposed to simply looking at the superstructures?
Yes, sir.
In fact, you can also look at MTN, the telecommunications company. It has become continental.
I'll say that there are various reasons for this, but essentially, let me deal with two. One, there is a historical reason for South Africa's reticence. South Africa is still a teenager amongst the free nations of Africa, as far as time. So South Africa, the South Africans are quite sensitive to this aspect of their existence within the continent. So they're always stepping with the light foot, because any country can always remind South Africa that, look, like Zimbabwe just did 4 months ago when South Africa sought to be kind of more assertive regarding migration from Zimbabwe. And the Zimbabweans told South Africans in no uncertain terms that Zimbabwe is not a province of South Africa. And South Africa had no answer to that. So South Africa is very sensitive to us being perceived as a neo-colonialist, because also of the problems that used to come from South Africa during apartheid times. So it's very easy then to tell South Africans, for any country that's misbehaving, look, don't come here with that apartheid mentality, and the South Africans will shirk that responsibility. Another reason, of course, is that South Africa it has developmental problems of its own. And so the business being ahead actually helps South Africa's budget back home than any democratic project. And a third and final reason would be, it's not South Africa looks at these high expectations of it as not fair. Because you also, when you're traveling around Africa, Dr. Shaka, see a lot of Chinese companies. The South Africans would say, should we ask the Chinese to help us also politically? So it's just business and there's politics. This is why I come back to the point that Africans must find endogenous ways to assess and improve their own democracy.
You mean indigenous ways?
Indeed, Dr. Shaka, a good country on this is Malaysia. Malaysia found out early on that if you have these elected leaders who come and pander after every 5 years and then go away after the promises, there's a certain instability associated with this. But also they were in a dilemma because they said, well, we still want democracy. So how do we merge these? Malaysia was brave and prescient. They have over five sultanates in Malaysia. In other words, what in Africa we call traditional leaders. So there's a council that sits of these traditional leaders, and it's not beholden to the government. So they actually certify the election of a prime minister. So if you run for an election in Malaysia, you still have to go to the king, and the king changes between the sultanates every 10 years. I stand for correction. But the point here is that you no longer need outside observers because you have people who have much more to lose guarding the elections and are not beholden to the electoral winds that blow every 5 or 6 years.
Interesting. Earlier, Norman, Dr. Puokule raised the issue of what he characterized as the Francophone.
Okay.
The Anglophone.
Mm-hmm.
He might in fact have added the Lusophone or Lusophonic, essentially those that were under the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
But what about his emphasis on the indigenous? What about, for example, promoting the issue of the Bantu, who basically have traced their origins in the Cameroon and crisscrossed the continent up to, in fact, Southern Africa? What about Africa uniting along the Bantuphone, or rather, in fact, as someday I was having an interview with Ugandan President General Yoweri Museveni Tibuhaburwa, and he mentioned what he characterized as Africophone. Why not that?
Philosophically, that is a very good idea. It's an ideal it's an ideal state of mind. For example, if you see the European Union, they have also done their union based on their culture and the way they would want development and all that kind of stuff. When you look at the African country
experiencing some political hiccups, hence Brexit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is what I was going to, that the Bantuphone for countries that relate or have history with Bantu would have been a very ideal club for the president to sit and take tea. I'll give you an example. In East Africa, we are struggling with the East African community. Yes. But one of the key issues that arise is that, one, you have a country which has the so-called democratic elections, Kenya. Every five years they change presidency. Mm-hmm. We are not sure. I wouldn't want to comment on the process in this East African community that we are facing today, where we have, for example, Kenya, they change leaders or they go for elections.
They have term limits.
Yes, they have term limits every after five. They say every 5 years, but normally the incumbent holds on to the next term. Same is with Tanzania under CCM, and Rwanda recently has gone to 7 years. And then you have Uganda, which is which has a president who has been in power for 34 years. So what are these people really going to talk about when, first of all, they have difference in ideology? We have one who believes he's the patron of all of these other leaders. He has a historical attachment to each and every leader, save Tanzania, of course, who have taken office in many of these East African countries, you know. So for me, in Africa or in East Africa for now, I would think having corporations, we still have to deal with our internal politics, so that we are closely at a semblance of levels so that we can be able to debate issues sensibly. Mm-hmm. Because if we are going to talk about a development issue, mm-hmm. and you're having a constitutional default in your back home,
yeah.
and the other one is having another yeah. issue of a would-be situation that's not in favor with the corporation, then that kills that entire, you know, coming together. That kills the club of tea takers as presidents. You've seen, pre-exit is not any different, you know. Many times, actually, they would have broken up long time ago because there was an imbalance in the economic existence between these countries, as well as policies, immigration, among others. So the Bantu phone, good idea, ideal situation, but not acceptable at this time.
Yeah, if I may, Dr. Shaga, may
yes,
I?
Please. Yes, please.
It goes back to the point I made earlier that the African leaders have found out, they know the narrative, they know the talking points, and they know how to perform the rituals. And some of these rituals involve a certain gospel. And this gospel usually is Pan-Africanism, anti-colonialism, anti-neo-colonialism. And we know quite well that, for example, in Zimbabwe, one of the lauded as a supreme Pan-Africanist was actually ex-president Robert Mugabe the late, actually presided over a kleptocracy for decades that took everything from the country, sent it outside, banks and the children of MPs having fancy houses in South Africa. But he was speaking the gospel on YouTube. He's a star, lots of subscribers on all his speeches. But the Pan-Africanism in effect and what he was supposed to bring, we know they don't occur in Zimbabwe, or we don't find the effect. So I agree with Norman on taking a dim view on uber Pan-Africanism, that behind which is actually kleptocracy and lack of accountability within the country. So African leaders, they know how to talk Pan-Africanism. And so that is why whenever we quote Kwame Nkrumah and we quote all these speeches from our very bright past, but we know that Pan-Africanism must still pass through the eye of the needle. And that eye of the needle is the country, the nation state, and whether or not the leaders in the nation state are accountable. And so far, if we are to judge Pan-Africanism and its prospects by how, for example, Zimbabwe turned out to be in the last 5 years, we would be very careful jumping on it without knowing the details.
Are we talking about a good message needing a good messenger?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Indeed. And I think I'm a practical person, and in my maybe it's me studying political economics, but what does it have to do with food on the table, peace in the land, stability in the country? And so if you're going to just be the disciple of Pan-Africanism, but in your country people are starving because you took the budget from the Ministry of Health and half of it, and you externalized it to be used by you and your cronies, then I don't want to hear about your Pan-Africanism, no matter how good it sounds.
That makes the case, you know, autocrats obviously like a situation where they are in control of the state,
yes.
especially given that the state in those particular contexts is the single largest employer and is the single largest contractor.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shaka.
Conversation. You're most welcome. Mm-hmm. On that note, our distinguished guests are Puokule Munyandu and Norman Mbabazi. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. Get better, not bitter. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.